I've been rewatching Gossip Girl because I've been sick. If you can't tell by the sound of my voice, I think in an earlier episode this season, I was complaining about how I had allergies. Turns out those weren't allergies. It was just like a really vicious cold, and it literally hasn't gone away. I've been sick for like 3 weeks and it sucks. But since I've been sick, I've been watching lots of Gossip Girl, and I just have so much to say. I already have a video about it. Hannah was also on the video. We made it like years ago. I'd be kind of embarrassed to go look at it now. That video took so much out of me, like so much work. It was insane. I think I dubbed myself in like the on-screen clips.
We both dubbed ourselves because we didn't really have the technological abilities to properly record ourselves. So we did have to actually sit down and dub ourselves like we were making a foreign movie.
I feel like I'm like an expert in it though now. Like it was really hard.
It was crazy. It was like in the pandemic, we went and filmed in downtown Toronto in our little Gossip Girl outfits.
In the middle of January, like we were freezing to death.
Like my mom had to drive us downtown, I think.
Yeah, like we weren't taking the subway. Yeah, it was just, it was a mess. But anyways, the whole thesis of that video is that like the show is set up against the poor characters so that it kind of like relies on this like in-group structure where like you as the audience want to feel part of the in-group, and so you end up also hating the poor people, like whatever, quote unquote poor, but like proximally poor people in the show, even though they do much less bad things than the rich people. Like we have them on a much shorter leash. And then in this new round of watching, I'm just like fascinated by the fact that like it is just a straight up soap opera from the beginning. Like it gets a little bit more outlandish, but like truly from the first episode, it is a soap opera. And it's made me think so much about how soap operas are so reliant on the concept of timing. Like timing is a character unto itself in these shows, where every single occurrence in the plot is just a result of timing. Someone walks in on someone while someone is doing something. Someone does something right at the very wrong moment, and then they can't do the thing they want to do. Like it's like they show up too late, they show up too early. Someone, like there's so many plot contrivances, like so many characters just showing up at an event that there's no need for them to be at. Like Vanessa, there's no need for her to be at probably in any scene in the first season, but she just ends up there for some reason, and then she walks in on two characters kissing at the same, like, you know, it's just, it's all about that. That's what the soap opera is. It's just timing.
And also though, time doesn't mean the same thing on these shows, because you also have people, especially in Gossip Girl, it's really clear. You have people who are traveling across the city of New York in order to have a 2-minute conversation with someone before they decide to leave, or, oh, something's come up. And it doesn't feel like it's taken anything out of their day.
No, living here now and knowing that like Dan and Jenny live in Dumbo and they're traveling up to the Upper East Side, that's a long commute. Like that is not short. They're just going up to the Upper East Side in like the blink of an eye. Or like Dan just happens to be hanging out up there. Like I don't think he would be hanging out up there. I think he'd be hanging out in Brooklyn.
No, but like then Serena will drop by to Brooklyn and then she'll be talking to one of them and then she'll be like, you know what? I gotta go. I gotta go deal with something that's back on the Upper East Side. I just came from there.
And we have to assume she's taking a driver because like she and the rich characters have drivers. And so you have to assume she's in a car. We're just stuck in traffic.
It doesn't make sense because people are also always rushing to get somewhere. And then there'll be always be like a big moment where all the characters are coming from all ends of the city to meet somewhere at the exact perfect time to catch someone before something happens.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's always meeting up in groups. Everyone just happens to be in the same place at all times, regardless of like where they live, who they are, what their status is. Like they're always in there.
Yeah, it is kind of magnificent. In that sense, I love that time doesn't really exist, that they live in this like kind of this space outside of time.
And here's what, the show is so genuinely well acted. I think all the acting's great in the show. I think Taylor Momsen is, I will defend her to my very last day. People hate on Taylor Momsen's acting. That baby was 14 and she acted her heart out. And I think she did an incredible job. And I love Jenny Humphrey. And I empathize with her so much, having been a teenage girl myself. I do not understand how people don't like that character. Anyways, she's doing an amazing job on this show. Like she is doing waterworks. She is mad at her dad. But everyone's genuinely great. Like they were really young when they filmed that. Like Blake Lively, I think, was like 19 or 20 during the first season. Leighton Meester was like 20 or 21. They're doing such a good job for their, like now that I'm older than them, I'm like, wow, you guys are actually incredible. All of them, The only one I'd say is like a little bit rocky is probably Chase Crawford.
But you know he's just there because he's pretty. Like he's not so there to be. He's not really given much to work with, but that's not his job anyway.
Well, he's actually given a lot to work with. He just doesn't do it. His character goes through intense shit. Like his dad punches him in the face in like one of the first episodes. And he's just kind of like, oh, dad, I'm mad at you. Like it's crazy.
Ooh, I know. Nate's probably the most boring character ever made though.
Oh, he gets so bad too as the show goes on. And like, even though it's like outlandish in its structure with the soap opera nature of it, it feels kind of sophisticated because the references and like dialogue are so witty. Like it is genuinely witty. It's making me laugh so hard. The jokes really land and they're funny. Like they're genuinely funny. And I don't know, like there's something sophisticated about like the delivery of the show that makes all of its like silliness work.
Oh, 1,000%. I've actually been rewatching Riverdale a little bit with my flatmates because we were doing a Gossip Girl rewatch, and it's, you know, I think Riverdale is a very fascinating show because I think it is just like a melting pot of pop cultural references that are too old or obscure for its target demographic. And I think from like a writing perspective, absolute insanity. And I've always like been very defensive of, I think that the women on the show, like the female actors, are bringing a lot more than the male actors. And I've always been defensive of their performances because I think seeing them also in other stuff, I think that like they're all like compelling screen presences. But this time around, like we're only on season one, but I'm like I'm very defensive of like Lily Reinhart. And I think Camila Mendes is like an underutilized rom-com protagonist. She should be like this generation's rom-com.
Well, she's in a queen. Movie recently. She's gonna be in something.
She does rom-coms, but we're obviously in an era where the rom-com isn't thriving, and I just think we need to invest more in the device that is Camila Mendes's charisma. But
nice.
Even still, watching them deliver lines that are just as ridiculous as the type of stuff that Blair Waldorf would say, they don't have, like, Leighton Meester makes you buy it. Leighton Meester just embodies that character in a way that is really underappreciated because, God love her, like, I think Camila Mendes's performance, like, gets better over the course of the show. But, like, the way she recites some of the lines, I'm like, I can just see her acting them.
It's Netflix-y,
and you don't believe it.
Yeah.
You don't buy it.
Blair's one of the best acting moments, I think, in the show is, like, in the first episode when Nate is revealing to Blair that he fucked Serena. And the specific look on Leighton Meester's face when he says that is exactly how any girl would look if they found that out. It is the most specific type of crying. It's not just, like, crying to cry. Like, she looks so hurt and so just, like, I wish you didn't tell me that in her face. And kind of like, I knew it also. And it's all wrapped up in one expression. And I just think it's incredible. And I remember as a kid just being so compelled by the show, so taken with it. And I really think a lot of that is due to the acting. Like, it truly is some great acting. I know people roast Blake Lively's acting abilities on there. I don't get it. Like, I actually think she does an amazing job.
No one else could be Serena. Like, okay, we all hate Blake Lively, blah, 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 whatever. I think that's boring. And I also think that, like, yes, she's blonde and beautiful, so we think less of her, and or we have, like, lower expectations for her, and we, whatever, are, like, I think primed to want her to fail. But I actually cannot imagine any other actress as Serena Vanderwoodson. I think that Blake Lively is like the perfect amount of like,
she's like a chill hot girl.
Yes, she's like the hottest girl you'd ever know, but also feels like a girl you could know. Like, she reminds me of my like really pretty friend growing up. Like,
and
you know,
her
what
hair
I mean?
Is a character on its own. Like, Eric Hair, Hair is doing some hair acting. She's great. Like, everyone's great. Penn Badgley just, like, is Dan. Like, it's just so well cast. So, I don't know. Roses to Gossip Girl. I really am, like, I thought I'd rewatch the first couple seasons because I've always defended the first two seasons. I love them. I think the show goes a bit south when they go to university. But I was worried that, like, at this age, I haven't watched it in a few years, I would go back and be like, oh, you know, it's a little much. And I have been laughing at some parts that probably as a kid I would have been like, oh, at. But generally, I'm just actually really impressed with the, it still kind of holds up.
One thing I'll say though is that in the first half of like the first season, Leighton Meester or Blair looks so good. Like, she's styled, I think, so well. And then halfway through the first season is when they start putting her in the like ridiculous sort of like bright colors,
the Chanel
over the
type.
Top.
Yeah.
Yeah, stuff. And it just, I'm like, you were styling her exactly like the intimidating, bitchy, rich girl who's, like, fashionable. Like, she looked so fucking good in the first
styling is so good. Like, I would wear all of that. Serena's outfit. Like, Serena's outfit where she wears a really tight leather jacket over a button-down and a tie. It's so cool.
Going back now, I'm, like, really appreciative of the fashion. I know it's because a lot of it's back in, but I do think they really dropped the ball with Blair's styling. Yeah. Like, the headband and the, like, J. Crew preppy of it all. When I
they
think
make her look really matronly.
So good at the beginning. Yeah. And I think that Chuck is so perfectly styled in the first season, and they also dropped the ball with that. And I think they should have just leaned in.
Yeah, they make them look old. Go watch my video. You can watch Baby Me and Baby Hannah dubbed. Yeah. And it'll be funny. But I actually am proud of that video. That was fucking brutal to make. So I think more people should watch it. I cannot even tell you how many hours that took. It was insane.
TBT.
TBT.
Actually, this is, like, very fitting. Because Maya, I want you to check your email. A la Gossip Girl.
Oh, no. Someone sent in a blind item about me. Oh, no. What is this? Forward. Read in all caps.
Do you want to read the email I've sent you?
Hannah's making me do all my voice acting today when I have no voice. But maybe it's going to work. Maybe it'll bring some pizzazz. Okay, so this is me talking in the present tense. I'm scrolling down through multiple empty threads. The subject is all in all caps, just read. I have arrived at the body text of the email. Okay, it's in blue writing, by the way. Okay, you have to read this, .. When I first read this email, I about had an accident in my pants. I was so freaked. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I actually saw it. It was the most freakiest thing ever. Okay, all you have to do is say your crush's name as many times as you can, and then something freaky will appear. Go! So basically, yeah, this is like the interlude, and it's like a body of asterisks making like a shape. I don't know if you guys remember that. It goes, "Stop!" in all caps. Okay, first you have to send this to at least 15 people. If you don't, if you send this to 0 people, you will have bad luck for the rest of your life. Font gets smaller as that reads on. 5 people, your crush will ignore you until your dying day. 10 people and your crush will ask you out. 15 people and your crush will kiss you on the cheek. 20 people and your crush will kiss you on the lips. 25 people and your crush will add some tongue plus all the others. 30 people and your crush will do much more. I feel like they probably didn't know what more was yet. Like, they were kind of like, I wonder what more is. The freaky thing about this email is after you send this to at least 15 people, come back onto this email and press shift and then F4 and you will see something amazing. It was so cool and freaky at the same time. So start sending and you only have 15 minutes, period, to send this, .. Go. And that's where the email ends.
Very good. Does this feel familiar to you? Have you ever received something of this nature before in your life?
Certainly, my dear. I can, like, truly pull it up so fast on my Hotmail. Just say the word. Lots of them were, like, Mickey Mouse related, usually.
Love that.
It was like, if you don't share this email, Mickey Mouse, who has no eyes, he's bleeding out of his eyes, he's gonna come into your room and kill you. And those ones never got me. Like, I was a scaredy cat, but that shit, I was like, this is stupid.
I think we forget that Mickey Mouse, or the concept of, like, dark, scary, evil Mickey Mouse, was, like, a prominent fixture in, I don't know, I feel like in early internet horror days.
Yeah, I think, like, any kind of, like, familiar, lovable cartoon character being dark was kind of a thing. Because it appeals to kids who were, like, in the realm of Mickey Mouse at that age, I guess, or like just coming out of that realm. But yeah, I got a lot of these emails. The crush ones worked on me because, you know, I was down bad.
Oh, of course. And it's like, you know, if someone's giving you an opportunity, you may as well take it. You may as well just give it a try. It doesn't hurt.
May as well. I mean,
but as I'm sure you can also surmise, this week's episode is about chainmail. And I want to sort of reappraise the art form, but also do a little bit of a dive into its history. So on that note, I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about communication on the internet. Online, we may have shot the shit, but have we also shot the messenger? If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out a lot. So I got my first email address in 2007 at the age of 10. And for those first couple of years before my friends and I had all been allowed to make Facebook accounts, at least half of my inbox was made up of chainmail. Just in case any of our younger listeners managed to completely miss out on this aspect of the internet, Maya, could you explain what a chain email is?
So it's essentially an email that, like, the origins of which are kind of unclear, that gets passed around between people. Usually it has some sort of like threat involved, or some sort of like there's stakes involved in the passing on of the email to get other people to send it. So like sometimes it'll rely on like fear, sometimes it'll be kind of like a manifestation of your wishes, like the crush one we just read. And they're usually quite long and like usually involve some sort of like visuals via, like, I don't know, the use of emojis today, but like back then the use of kind of like different signs and symbols to create visuals. So like for the Mickey Mouse emails, for example, like they'd make a big Mickey Mouse out of different, like, yeah, like asterisks and like brackets and stuff. Yeah, and they'd be long. And then usually they're shared among young people, but like in one episode of Sex and the City, I think Charlotte tells Samantha to stop sending her chain mail. And Samantha's like, but it's funny. I think it's chain mail, or it's like a horny greeting card, maybe. I don't know. But I remember that.
I think we associate chain emails with young people because maybe we were young when we were sending them. But like, if you think about it, mostly like email was used by adults.
The internet was new to everyone at that time, too. Like, yeah. It was new to all of us.
I would say we have to think of adults as people who are also like participating in this, because they absolutely were.
Michael sends it on The Office.
Yes, precisely.
An adult.
Like you were kind of saying, there are many subcategories of chain emails, and I thought it'd be kind of fun to break some of these down using real life examples from my old inbox. So I've just sent you a bunch more.
Oh, good.
The first category is altruistic emails, so emails that are spreading awareness of a cause, or which claim that, like, if you share them, money will be donated to said cause. Mm-hmm. So if you want to read this one.
I love that there's no, like, BCC on here, so you just get every single person's name from the original, like, mailing list. Mm-hmm. They're so long, the actual text of the email, like, it's so drawn out. Okay.
Yeah, I know.
Please read this. It is really sad. And if you don't read this, that means you are extremely mean and selfish. I'm 11 years old. My mommy worked on the 20th floor. Oh my God.
Sorry, I should have warned you before you started reading in that voice.
In the World Trade Tower. On September 11th, do I have to change my tone of voice here? Okay. On September 11th, 2001, my daddy drove my mom to work. She was running late, so she left her purse in the car. My daddy saw it, so he parked the car and went to give her the purse. I'm scrolling between, like, these lines are broken up by, like, 50 lines each. Like, they're very...
Without any, like, reason, because this is supposed to be the same sentence.
They just want you to keep reading. That day after school, my daddy didn't come to pick me up. Instead, a policeman came and took me to foster care. Finally, I found out why my daddy never came. I really loved him. They never found his body. My mom has been in the hospital since then. She is losing lots of blood. She needs to go through surgery. But since my daddy is gone and no one is working, we have no money. And her surgery costs lots of money. So the Red Cross said that. Again, 50 lines between. So the Red Cross said that, ... For every time this email is forwarded, we will get 10 cents for my mom's surgery. So please have a heart and forward this to everyone you know. I really miss my daddy, and now I don't want to lose my mommy too. R.I.P. Daddy, in brackets, James Thomas. Please forward this email to as many people you know. For each person you send it to, the Red Cross will donate 10 cents for mom's operation. This message was sent by Olive, aka Olivia.
Obviously, yeah, what it's saying here is that if you forward this, 10 cents will be donated by the Red Cross. Obviously, that is not how charity or funding or medical bills or anything works. But it's, remember this, also this email was sent in either 2007 or 2008. So much closer to the events of September 11th.
Yes.
So that's the first category, like altruistic. The next is something that Snopes called something from nothing emails, which are emails that promise that if you pass them along, you'll be rewarded financially. So if you want to read that one.
Sorry. Okay. The title of this email is, if it's true, comma, I'm raffling off the certificate, because they misspelled the word certificate. Okay. Scrolling. As I scroll down, people are jumping in being like, this really works. Okay, we're just scrolling. Hello, everyone. My name is Amber McClurkin. You've probably heard about the email from Gap offering free clothes to anyone who will forward the message on. Well, I am the founder of Abercrombie & Fitch, and I am willing to make a better deal with you. These were all broken up like stanzas, like a Rupi Kaur poem. And I am willing to make a better deal with you. You will receive a $25 gift certificate for every 5 people you forward this to. This is a sales promotion in order to get our name, again, out to young people around the world. We believe this project can be a success, but only with your help. Thank you for your support. Sincerely, Amber McClurkin, founder of Abercrombie & Fitch. The founder. Weren't they founded in, like, whenever the fuck? And then at the bottom, it's, like, from a girl named Amy. Amy says, this works. I got a $200 gift card. That's why I bought so much Abercrombie this week. I would have fallen for that shit so fast.
I 1000% forward this on, and you guys, it did work. And I had such a nice wardrobe in 2008, thanks to Amber McClurkin.
The Depop resellers are squealing and they're kicking their feet.
Oh, on that note, I was on Vinted. The girlies are selling like quote unquote vintage Abercrombie and Hollister, meaning of this era, like 2008 to 2010.
Yes,
they're selling that shit for like £90.
Yeah, are we shocked?
Yeah.
I'm not. Girl, that's been on there for years at this point.
But I don't get it. It's just mall clothes. There's so much of it out there. There's no scarcity.
20-year cycle, girl.
It's and not like, even that, though. Trend. But like, sure, sell it for £25. That's an up price. 90?
£25. They weren't cheap back in the day. They were upselling as fuck because the clothes, they weren't cheap. That was like the expensive clothes.
But people, like, that is clothes that was probably worn to death by a 12-year-old, like, 15
Darling,
years ago. Anyways.
You know what's going on. You know.
I know. I'm still news. A little gooped and gagged by this one.
Gooped and gagged.
The third category is humor.
Ooh.
This one's really long, so you don't have to read all of it because it's quite long.
I'll try my best.
But just a few examples.
Boy, oh boy, am I excited. So this one's called Yo Mama. Yo mama's so stupid that she... Okay, basically the text is in all different colors. It's very large text. Again, huge gaps between the text. Yo mama's so stupid that she called me to get my phone number. Yo mama's so stupid that she spent 20 minutes looking at the orange juice box because it said concentrate. Yo mama's so stupid she put lipstick on her forehead because she wanted to make up her mind. Yo mama's so stupid she tried to put M&Ms in alphabetical order. Yo mama's so stupid she sent me a fax with a stamp on it. Yo mama's so stupid, she tried to drown a fish. Yo mama's so stupid, she thought a quarterback was a refund. Okay, like, sports are stupid, so she's smart. Yo mama's so stupid, she got locked in a grocery store and starved to death. Okay. Yo mama's so stupid, she tripped over a cordless phone.
I like that one.
Pretty good. Yo mama's so stupid, she took a ruler to bed to see how long she slept. Yo mama's so stupid, she asked for a price check at the dollar store. Yo mama's so stupid, she studied for a blood test. Yo mama's so stupid, she thought Meow Mix was a CD for cats. That's bad. Yo mama's so stupid, when she heard that 90% of all crimes occur around the home, she moved. Yo mama's so stupid, when she missed the 44 bus, she took the 22 bus twice instead.
That one's pretty good.
Yo mama's so... It's just fun. Yo mom is so stupid. When she took you to the airport and saw a sign that said airport left, she turned around and went home. She's kind of clever. Like, I think she's kind of clever, mama.
She's just like a free thinker.
I'm almost done. Okay. Yo mom is so stupid. She threw a bird off a cliff to kill it. Yo mom is so stupid. She turned off the big fan in a helicopter when she got cold. Now send this to at least 5 people or you'll get bad luck for 7 years. And then it just has like a list of like the similar to the crush thing. You send to 5 people, maybe your crush will like look at you.
Sideways. Yeah. Wow, beautiful. There's something about hearing your mama jokes read out in that raspy voice that brings me back to prepubescence.
Because I'm like a pubescent puberty boy.
Yeah,
your mama.
Oh no.
Hey Hannah, you wanna hold hands behind the slide?
Oh God. I mean, honestly, going through my old emails for research for this and seeing my email exchanges with my crushes, ouch. I'm like, no wonder I love emotionally unavailable men, because damn, I was set up from the jump. It was so crazy shit. So the next example is, I've not sent you an example email because it's kind of boring, but it's just friend surveys / lists. And it's where you get your friends to put their names down for every person like you sent it to. And it was basically just like, how long of a list can we create? Or it'd be like, write down your friend's name that you call when you're sad. Write down your friend's name that's the funniest, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then the next category is uplifting chain emails. So you can read the one I've sent you.
Can't believe you found one for each of these examples. I'm impressed. Okay. I love you. That's what it's called. There's also like a disclaimer from someone named Alyssa that says, sorry, it's chain.
That might be from my friend Alyssa, who sent me a lot of these chain emails.
I love that it's like a sorry, but she's sending it anyways. What would you do if for every moment you were truly happy, there would be 10 moments of sadness, and then it's like a little sad goblin face underneath? What would you do if your best friend died tomorrow and you never got to tell them how you felt? So I just wanted to say, if I never talk to you again in my life, you were special to me and you have made a difference in my life. There's some cherubs underneath that. I look up to you, respect you, and truly cherish you. Butterfly emoji. Send this to all your friends, no matter how often you talk or how close you are, and send it to the person who sent it to you. Ice cream emoji. Let old friends know you haven't forgotten them, and tell new friends you never will. What looks to be an image from Trailer Park Boys. Remember, everyone needs a friend. Someday you might feel like you have no friends at all. Just remember this email and take comfort in knowing somebody out there cares about you and always will. And it's doggies hugging in times of trouble. It just keeps going, bro. So many platitudes. It's amazing how much they can come up with.
They just want an excuse to put more like gifts in there. They're like, hey, I found this cute little animation.
In times of trouble, in times of need, if you are feeling sad, you can count on me. I will give you a wink. And then it's like a sexy girl emoji. Until you smile, Garfield emoji, give you a hug, hugging bears emoji, and stand by your side. I'll be there for you till the end. I'll always and forever be your friend. Friend emoji. Instantly when you receive this, you must send it to at least 10 friends. Hugs emoji.
Very sweet. And you know what, Maya? When I read that, I thought of you.
Thank you.
I wanted to forward it to you just for fun.
You made this whole episode up just so you could send me that email.
Yeah. And the next one is emails warning people about scams or viruses, which themselves were scams because they were usually hoaxes. Yeah.
And I got a lot of these. Please read. Okay, this is the title. Please read. It isn't chainmail. It is very important. Trust me. All in caps. It starts like this. All the letters are separated because we have to make this annoying for Maya to read. Important warning! Exclamation points. Please read. Pass this on to your email buddies. Heed the warning. It sounds awful. Anyone using internet mail such as Yahoo, Hotmail, AOL, and so on. This information arrived this morning. Direct from both Microsoft and Norton. Please send it to everybody you know who has access to the internet. It's so ESL, like the way this was written. You may receive an apparently harmless email with a PowerPoint presentation. Life is beautiful. If you receive it, do not open the file under any circumstances and delete it immediately. if you open this file, a message will appear on your screen saying, it is too late now. Your life is no longer beautiful. Subsequently, you will lose everything in your PC, and the person who sent it to you will gain access to your name, email, and password. This is a new virus which started to circulate on Saturday afternoon. AOL has already confirmed the severity, and the antivirus softwares are not capable of destroying it. The virus has been created by a hacker who calls himself Life Owner.
That's a sick hacker name.
Yeah, it's actually really cool. Please send a copy of this email to all your friends and ask them to pass it on immediately. This has been confirmed by Snopes, and then it's signed off Snopes.com. Life is beautiful. Virus.
Which I then checked Snopes to see if this was a hoax or not, and Snopes was like, it's a hoax, as I'm sure you can imagine.
I love that the virus signed itself virus. Like, they were like, best regards, virus. It said, bisous.
Bisous. And then the last category are emails that either promise good luck or threaten bad luck, just like the one you read up at the top of this episode. Thank you so much for those beautiful readings, Maya. I hope I've not strained your vocal cords too much.
I'm not talking again the rest of this episode.
Oh, shit. This can be a boring-ass episode.
Guys, the holidays are just around the corner. Personally, I like to get my shopping done early. The only problem is I'm always holding out for the perfect gift, which isn't always easy to find. Luckily for me and my loved ones, Quince has me covered. With Quince, you can find luxurious gifts like cashmere sweaters or Italian wool jackets for super reasonable prices. Hannah told me she's never felt fancier than when she puts on her new Mongolian cashmere sweater from Quince, and she loves to see the shock on people's faces when she tells them it was only $50. Plus, her fingers are going to stay nice and toasty all winter long thanks to her beautiful shearling gloves. And if you thought Quince was only looking out for the fashion girlies, you thought wrong. Quince has gifting options for everyone in your life, from the home cooks to the world travelers. I, for one, have been cooking up a storm in my stainless steel saute pan, which I bought after having a freak out about nonstick, but that's a story for another time. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash. Being moody doesn't have to be a bad thing. Sometimes it can be fun to lean into how we're feeling by surrounding ourselves with things that match that feeling. Our moods play a big role in our choice of music, food, even lighting. So why not extend that logic to cannabis products? This is possible thanks to our sponsor, Mood, an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC products right to your door. Gummies that only get you high? That's so passé. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. And with our promo code REHASH, you can get 20% off your first order at mood.com. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, sleepy time to get you settled for a restful night, or chill out for some needed relaxation. THC gummies are everywhere these days, so why not go with a brand that lets you customize your experience? Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. The best part is, Mood ships directly and discreetly to your door. That means no more waiting in dispensary lines, and no risk of an awkward run-in with your mom's friend Mary. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code REHASH. So head to mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code REHASH when you check out to save 20% off your first order.
So for as long as we've had email, people have sent chain emails, but their history actually goes back further than the internet. The folklorist Daniel W. Van Arsdale, who seems to be the go-to expert on the subject of chainmail, he has an extensive archive of chain letters that date back to 1795. Those early iterations were often religious. So the oldest known handwritten chain letter is referred to as, quote, letter from heaven. And in it, it threatens the recipient if they don't hand copy it and send it on. And it tells like a story about Jesus, basically. But in the centuries that followed, we'll see the evolution of a lot of the subcategories that we discussed above, like letters preying on people's superstitions about luck, or a genre of letters called sendadimes, which were essentially early pyramid schemes. It was like, if you send a dime to these people, then you'll get like 5 dimes back, and the more people you send it to, you know. And as the practice grew and technological advancements made them easier to create and disseminate, the chainmail creators got more creative, finding new ways to like entice people to pass them along, like the ones we've seen above, kind of appealing to all these different senses. So back in the day, when you would receive chain emails, did you ever pass them along?
Definitely. I mean, I don't know what I was up to back then. I was up to probably everything and anything on the internet. I was being so annoying. I don't remember the act of doing it, but I know if I went back to my Hotmail, I would be confronted with some pretty heinous chain. Like, if I went to my send box from 2008, you can bet your ass it was probably all chain mail.
Yeah, like, I'm sure at least, like, 50% of it, as mine was, when I wasn't, like, harassing my crushes or fighting with my friends in, like, all caps abbreviations.
Hannah was sending me all her, like, friend fight emails, and they were so upsetting.
I was like, I'm ugly and poor and not even good at sports. And all of my crushes like my friends.
It was so crazy.
Poor baby. And then my friend was like, you're not that ugly or poor.
You're not that ugly.
Yeah, life is beautiful. So, no, I definitely sent along chain emails. And what's funny is that, like, amongst the chain emails in my old inbox were a ton of emails from friends asking me to stop sending them chain emails. But then those same people would send chain emails to me. So it was this weird thing where we all hated getting them, but we all passed them along. The question is, why? Like, I think, like, if we think about chain emails, which I feel fairly confident in stating this, even though it's a mass generalization, but, like, those are one of the few universally hated things. It's, like, one of those unifiers, right? Like, we're such a divided species, whatever, but we all hate getting chain emails. And yet, they continued on. So, why? Like, why do you think people forwarded chain emails?
I mean, it's just, like, the effort of doing it is so low compared to, like, the stakes that are threatened in the email that it feels like...
True.
Like, what you had been saying earlier, just kind of a why not? Like, I guess I'll just try this, let's see what happens, you know? Better not to, you know, get hexed by Mickey Mouse for 15 years. Like, I may as well just send this just in case. Like, I know it's not real, but that's, like, my best guess. Yeah, like, the why not aspect, and then, like, people actually believing them, like, the fear-based aspect, or, like, maybe people... with optimism who are like taking that crush shit seriously, you know? It's like gotta be one or the other.
Well, I think like, yeah, each of these subcategories kind of is defined by a different incentive to get you to forward them along. And they are, yeah, appealing to these basic human instincts. So there's the fear aspect, like, yeah, you don't want bad luck. You don't want to get like a creepy phone call, which they often threaten shit like that, or like get hit by a bus the next day. Superstition as well. But then there's also like goodwill. You're like, well, if somebody sent me this nice email telling me how much they love me, would it be bad if I didn't pass it on to more people and let them know that I love them? It's like a chain of goodwill. You don't want to break that. Or then there's the greed aspect, you know, oh, maybe if I forward this along, I'm somehow gonna like benefit from it, like monetarily.
And it's so funny because now, like, so basically we have this friend, I'll shout her out by name, Miss Ali Berry.
Legend.
An absolute legend. She, every single, whatever, holiday of the year, will send everyone she knows, like, a really sexually explicit chain text. I wish I could find one.
Full of emojis. I'm sure you could. If you looked up, like, Slutsgiving or something, I'm sure you'd find it. But it's basically just, like, a bunch of euphemisms surrounding whatever holiday it is.
Cocktober.
But you want to know what's so Dickmas. Funny? Dickmas, yes. So Allie will send these into our group chat that we're in. But then in a separate group chat that I'm in with my high school friends, someone will always end up sending the same one.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is that chain mail thing going on. It's like on that day, there's a network of girlies sending these around, and like passing it around the city of Toronto and it will show up. Like, whatever group chat you're in,
yeah,
there's a very good chance.
I haven't gotten it this year. I'm kind of sad. Ali.
We're recording this 2 days before Halloween, so there's still time for Cocktober.
There's always time for Cocktober. Yeah, I wait, but yeah, I send them on now because I think it's funny.
No, I mean, obviously now it's like there's a nostalgic element to it too. There's a tongue-in-cheek thing.
And they're via iMessage, not email.
Yeah, and you're like, hey guys, remember this stuff that we used to do. But it's also like it's a novelty because we do it like seasonally. We do it every once in a while. Whereas these chain emails, like that was like daily.
It's a lifestyle.
That was a commitment. And like you had to like know the go-to people you were going to send that to. So it's like a...
My day ones. Whole...
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, as much as we all hated receiving chain emails, we were also the ones keeping them alive, which I think is kind of interesting to think about. Like their continuation was completely dependent on public participation. And as Finn Arsdale told Vice in an interview, he said, chain letters are designed to replicate. And that's just kind of an interesting thing to me, like this idea of repetition and passing on from person to person and how important they are. Because it's what makes a chain email more than a mere annoyance, but actually a new form of folklore.
Ooh.
So I'm going to give a sort of basic definition of folklore. Researching this episode, I realized that there's actually a lot of debate within like the study of folklore as to like what exactly qualifies as folklore. But generally speaking, the term refers to stories and traditions which are passed on among a particular group or culture. So that could include things like songs, nursery rhymes, recipes, stories, bits of wisdom, idioms, cures that are like kind of orally shared, or chain letters. And folklore is often shared orally, but this isn't a strict guideline, as in the case of chain letters. But there tends to be an emphasis on the performance aspect of it because it's often like meant to be received by an audience. Chain letters, while not performed, they still count as a form of folklore because they're traditionally handwritten and containing things like sort of urban legends, hoaxes, luck charms, poems, and their origins are often untraceable, which is also kind of an important aspect of folklore. And they're passed along by people within a shared community or network, typically. Could you think of any other examples of folklore that like you've sort of grown up around? It doesn't even have to necessarily be like traditional or anything, but like things from life that count as folklore.
Well, okay, so my grandma was quite religious. She's Hindu. So I grew up thinking these things were religious and then like had it debunked that actually things she would pass on to us weren't religious. It was just that like my mom and her siblings grew up in like a really small rural village. So like there were things that just got passed around between people because it was just a more superstitious community because it was kind of remote and like whatever, whatever. So like my grandma would pass these things on to us and then we'd go to my mom. My mom would be like, why would she tell you that? Like she'd be like, if my cousin was sitting down on the ground and his legs were stretched out, like we weren't allowed to walk over his legs because it would stunt his growth. So if we did it, we had to walk back the other way over his legs. There was a whole thing about like, you can't wear like a long braid behind your head because someone will come and snatch you, like pull you by the braid and snatch you.
So that's pretty pragmatic.
It's pretty pragmatic. There was like quite a lot of them. My cousins still kind of hold on to these. I actually don't know if this is religious or not, but basically I was born like a breached birth where I came out foot first. And my grandma, I don't know if it's in the Hindu religion or just like in Kayana, like just in the culture where she was from, but like she thought I had like a magic foot. So like I would like rub my foot on her back whenever she was having back pain and she said it cured her.
Oh my God, wait. Why didn't you tell me about this when we were living together all these years?
I know, I could have cured you with my magic foot. Yeah, yeah. But she really believed it. She'd be like, oh, thank you. So yeah, that was like, I grew up in a pretty intensely superstitious like environment with my grandma. So that was kind of what I had. And then in terms of like school folklore, outside of that folk, I can't think of anything.
Well, stuff like Ring Around the Rosie, like that's sort
of something. Oh, Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary had a gorilla grip over me. Like, she fucking, so basically my entire childhood, I convinced myself that if my feet were touching the ground when the toilet stopped flushing, I would get killed by Bloody Mary. So I'm not kidding. Up until the age of probably 13, I was hoisting myself up onto whatever sink there was and like holding myself up there until the toilet stopped flushing. Yeah. So that's, I don't know. And I probably was told that by like some naughty friend of mine.
Well, yeah, I think it's like a lot of folklore when I think about it is stuff that kids sort of just like teach each other and no one knows where they first heard it, but they pass it on and there's like no way of like pinpointing the origins. And it can be creepy stuff, but it could also be stuff like Miss Mary had a steamboat, her steamboat had a bell, ding ding.
Hannah and I crushed that one time.
Yeah.
Okay, wait, ready?
Like, that's,
the steamboat yeah. went wait,
to hello operator.
Operator, please connect me number nine. And if you disconnect me,
me
a little behind the magic curtains, there was a, piece, of glass.
A piece of glass.
And when Miss Mary sat upon it, she heard her
ask me no more questions.
Tell me no more lies.
There's a lag, so I think we're both doing this really weird.
Only tell their lies.
The third lies are in the city, the bees are in the park. Miss Mary and her boyfriend are kissing in the D-A-R-K. Dark is like a movie, a movie's like a show.
A show is like a video, and that is all I know. See, it's like, but it's like the inertia of it. Like, I couldn't, if you were to sit me down and be like, can you write this out? I wouldn't. Like, I have to sing it.
Well, exactly. It was like orally shared to you and you heard it enough times that it's just been ingrained in your brain. Like, I remember it. I have memorized and performed monologues later in my life that I don't remember.
I did one of my Macbeth monologues recently just in my room.
Our friend Rosalind was visiting me in London and we went to see The Merry Wives of Windsor at the Globe, and then afterwards we were talking about our Shakespeare monologues and I pulled up my Juliet monologue that I did in grade 12 and I performed it for her on the street in London. The way the performance just came out of me, like I remembered how I performed it even though I didn't remember the words. But anyways, that's not relevant. But yeah, stuff like that. And then I don't know, I think about kind of similar to you, like weird kind
strawberry of shortcake blueberry pie, tell me who's your strawberry shortcake blueberry pie, tell me who's your sweetie pie.
Mm-mm.
Oh, it's like a rope jumping song. Anyways, it's like a double dutch song.
All of that kind of stuff. I was thinking about like weird medical advice. Like, my mom convinced me growing up that all of my ailments could be cured by either peroxide or pseudocreme, which is diaper cream.
That's awesome.
And I don't know if that's folklore, but like that sounds like something that someone told her and someone told them, and it's just been sort of passed along, and it feels very old country to me.
It's like the Windex in My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Also, like, there was something that got passed around recently on Instagram that was like different. So in Canada we have a song called Stella Ella Ola, and apparently it's just Canadian, like Americans don't do this. I learned from this graphic.
What?
And there's a different iteration of Stella Ella Ola in every province. So like our version is different from like
Quebec. Stella Ella Ola. That was my terrible French accent. I'm gonna kill myself. Stella Ella Ola. quick. Yeah, they don't have Stella Ella Ola outside of Canada.
Apparently not, which I was like, damn. But like, I know that whole damn thing and I could do the game. I did it with my nieces recently.
So these kinds of things might initially seem antithetical to the internet because, you know, it's pretty easy to find the origin of most things that get disseminated online. And obviously nothing is being passed around by word of mouth in the literal sense on the internet. And the internet also seems like something that would be damaging to the proliferation of folk culture in a lot of ways. However, I thought it was very interesting to find that within the discipline of folklore studies, there are some very strong cases being made for the opposite, that in some ways the internet has actually helped revive certain aspects of folk culture that have been lost over time as societies have changed.
Well, yeah, I feel like globalization kind of like collapsing regional cultures would kind of affect, you know, let's say like the Stella Ella Ola effect of like each province having a different version of Stella Ella Ola. But, you know, because like TikTok has made it so that you go to like a Brazil and someone's referencing the same thing that you've seen. But then in a sense, that's like a whole other version of like global folklore, you know, some teen in like, I don't know, Sardinia doing a TikTok dance, for example, and then
yeah,
someone also doing it in like Nigeria. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. And I think, while, like, in a lot of ways, the internet has, like, sped up the process of IRL folklore sort of dying off, I think it's opened the doors, like you're saying, to new kinds of folklore, but also, like, for new folk groups to emerge. So we obviously covered this extensively in our season on online subcultures, but the internet has been ripe with niche communities since its genesis. And some of these communities have famously even helped build it, like Deadheads or Dungeons and Dragons fans. And, you know, the internet has long offered up spaces for these groups to not only congregate, but to grow and flourish in ways that they wouldn't in real life, making them even more kind of solid as groups or communities. And while they may differ from groups that are, like, linked by race or nationality or location, they're still producing their own shared cultures, ones with, like, distinct slang, phrases, lore, and which might disseminate that then into, like, the general culture. So if you think of something like Black Twitter, how much that's influenced, like, the vernacular online, or gamers and their slang. I just listened to a really interesting podcast about the origin of the cuck as an archetype, but then also, like, how that became slang and how that went from being a niche gamer thing into, like, something that all of us use, basically. And these groups are often built on people sharing media and information with one another without charge for the sake of sharing. And so this emphasis on sharing actually brings us back to another key aspect of folklore, which I said earlier, which is performance. So performance in this case doesn't necessarily mean, like, getting up on stage in front of a crowd. The folklorist Andrew Peck calls the transmission of folklore a kind of, quote, emergent performance, which, quote, comes into being through the interaction of performer and audience. He continues that performances influence and imagine their audiences, and in turn, audiences participate in the creation of the performances. This mutually constitutive interaction between performance and audience creates an ongoing feedback loop, affecting not only what is currently being performed, but also the nature of successive performances. So, for example, there is an Irish folk song slash, I think it's a song and poem, but it's called The Highwayman. And my granddad used to perform it at, like, every gathering or party.
Aww.
And he'd recite it from memory rather than, like, off a page. And in turn, he'd be able to sort of experience the reception of his performance with the crowd at that gathering, which might vary depending on who was there. But then also it was sort of this thing where people, especially like my mom and her siblings, who would hear it in all of these different settings over time, like, have it now ingrained in them the way I guess we would have something like Stella Elaola ingrained in us.
It's giving Christopher Plummer singing Edelweiss and Liesel joining him, and then they sing it together.
I used to have nightmares for some reason where that song was playing.
What? It's such a beautiful song.
I won't get into it because explaining your own dreams are really boring, but I used to have these weird dreams where there was a weird little creature and it used to sing Edelweiss at me.
That's so funny. And it sort of soured
a beautiful tune.
Edelweiss.
But yeah, totally. I think over the years, I can imagine, like, my granddad's performance changing, or like him improving it or tweaking it just by doing it so many times, and doing it for different types of people. And I think that's a really interesting thing to think about, because in a pre, like, mass industrialization world, this would be a much more typical occurrence, you know, having people share these things orally and learn them through repetition. But it's changed, you know, since stories could be printed and songs could be recorded for mass consumption, and we sort of lost this emphasis on performance. But digital folklorists argue that the internet has actually given us a new way to kind of simulate that experience. So in the case of the chain email, this boils down to how they're written. Like, looking back at the emails we read up top, can you identify any distinguishing qualities in their syntax?
Just extremely, like, broken up, sporadic writing, and also extremely, like, choppy grammar, like, lots of typos often, the sentences kind of, like, cut off midway through, weird use of punctuation, often they'll be very, like, colorful in their presentation, which the ones that weren't colorful, like, they bored me, I won't lie. the ones that were colorful, I was like, oh yeah, you know.
There's something very emphatic about the way they're being, like you read them.
There's a visual storytelling there, especially because, like, yeah, often in the ones I used to get, they would make up an image, like the words would turn into an image if you like scrolled it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it would look like a big cat or something.
No, exactly. And they're also like they're written very informally, like they're being spoken to you. I think there's something really interesting, like even the 9/11 one, for example. This is a chain email that like was being written with the intention of it being passed from person to person to person, and yet it's as if the original writer is speaking directly to you, like kind of breaks that barrier, which I found really cool. They address the recipient directly. They're like, you, not to whom this may concern. And then there's a lot of emphasis on time. Like, if you do this in the next 15 minutes, this will happen. Or once you send this out, you'll get a phone call from your crush tonight. Or you only have this much time to do this. Go.
And lots of numbers, too. Like use of numbers. Like, how many people you send it to has, like, a value attached to it.
For sure. But in this case of time, I think what this does is it creates this illusion of a shared presence. Because if you think about it, the person who wrote this might have written it like 12 months ago, for all you know. Mm. But the way you're reading it, it's as if it was just conjured up that night. Like, you don't really need to know how long this email has been circling around.
Well, even the 9/11 one, it's like, my mother is currently bleeding, you know, and it's like sent in 2008.
Yeah. Like 7 years out. It doesn't really matter. It kind of, like Gossip Girl, breaks down time and space.
Very good, Hannah. Very good.
So the folklorist Marjorie Kibbe refers to email as a, quote, form of secondary orality, which basically means that it closely and eerily resembles actual oral communication despite being conveyed over text. And she argues that, like, this approach to writing, one, helps kind of make the case for chain emails as a form of folklore, even though they're obviously text-based, but also like helps persuade us to send them on because we're kind of being addressed in this really interpersonal way that I think compels us more than if you received an email that was written, you know, like if you got an email from your school that was like, just so you know, like there'll be no classes today because we're shutting this down, and they're not like, hey, you guy, you can't go to class. They're talking more generally.
Your principal's like, hey, quick,
forward, please read, no spam. And so if you think of the chain email as a practice which evolved over time, essentially adopting, you know, different tactics to ensure its survival, then there are definitely signs of that feedback loop we were talking about earlier, with successful tactics being taken on to entice people to open them and resend them. Like, I saw some emails that would be chain emails, but they would have the subject line, I'm moving to China, !! And then obviously you click on it because you think your friend is moving to China. And then they're like, psych, sorry, this is a chain email, but it's really important that you send it along.
Some of them got my ass for sure.
And going through my inbox, like for this, I believed it. I clicked on those again because I was like, why am I getting an email telling me this so-and-so is moving to China? Did so-and-so move to China? So if we're thinking about digital folklore, chain emails are really just the tip of the iceberg. Like, so much of what makes up our lives online can be defined as digital folklore. Can you think of any examples?
Well, in our coming episode, we're going to talk about memes. And I feel like memes definitely carry on that tradition of, like, passing something along. Although the original is not really, like, preserved in that case often. It's, like, transformed into something else. But, yeah, I mean, the best I can think of is memes. Slender Man, for example, which we have our bonus episode on, which you guys should go listen to because it's really fun. Plug.
So internet challenges. I mean, even like you were talking about earlier with TikTok. Like, I think a TikTok dance is a pretty good example, right? TikTok, if you think about something that's being replicated and performed and passed along and people are commenting on it. So they're also in this feedback loop.
Any sort of like TikTok comment, like, you know how there's like kind of the repeated comments, like, hope this helps, you know, like those kind of comments. I feel like those are almost folklore. Like, people will like pick that up and use it. Like, people will just keep repeating the same comment over and over again on TikTok as if they thought of that themselves. Like, there's, like, these little phrases from TikTok that get passed along in comment sections.
I mean, those are almost like memes, right? You're, like,
kind of, but they're comments.
Fan fiction as well. Like, a lot of stuff that happened on Tumblr. Because also, like, you're putting this out to an audience, but also people are kind of then reblogging and reusing what each other puts out. Copy pastas. I read this great article in Art News by Ruby Justice Thillo.
I think Thillo. I should know this because I actually know him in real life. Hi, Ruby. Shout out to Ruby. I didn't know Hannah was going to reference him here.
No, this is such a funny small world.
He was the moderator at my book launch, a dear friend, etc. Et
plug my Yo's book. Go read it.
Plug my book.
So in the article, he makes the case for the content creator as a kind of digital folk artist. So in particular, he's referring to creators who make content for niche communities and audiences who they have an ongoing rapport with. And he actually uses Swifties as an example of people who create content dedicated to analyzing her work and participating in activities like making friendship bracelets or outfits for concerts. And says, quote, two centuries ago, this array of creation would have been considered folk art, both tangible in the case of the bracelets and intangible in the case of the stories and analysis. And then he goes on to write, for many creators, the craft of content is a devotional act to the community in which they participate. They spend their own precious time making content, usually for no or very little compensation. Creators, to some extent, exist outside the understood financial incentives of digital media, even as they are subject to its technological forces. The folk aspect of content creation comes from the authentic and personal feel that characterizes traditional folk objects. But he identifies a major threat to digital folk culture. Do you want to take a guess as to what that is?
Knowing Ruby, I'm assuming he's talking about AI.
Yes, generative AI.
That's right.
He likens the effects of generative AI on digital folk culture to that of the Industrial Revolution on traditional folk arts. How these things present themselves as democratizing forces, things that are going to make it easier and cheaper and less time consuming to create and disseminate art. On the surface, this could be seen as a good thing, but can you think of any drawbacks specifically pertaining to folk culture? Or folk arts.
Well, I guess it'll fragment us. I mean, I feel like the most amazing thing about folk art is that it's like man-made, like it's human-made. Humans created it, and so there's always kind of like a footprint there. Like there's like a source to trace it back to. Even though you can't actually trace it back, like the beauty of it is that you can't trace it back. The knowledge that it was originally created by some person is so cool, and I think that's kind of like part of the mystery of it and like the magic of it. And knowing that I feel like AI cuts the source kind of changes the nature of folklore in general. Like, it doesn't really count as folklore anymore.
1,000%. There's also, like, if we're thinking about it in terms, and this is how he poses it in the article, and if we're thinking about it in relation to something like the Industrial Revolution, these things, they reduce a need for artisan or creator-made products, and the market then becomes, like, flooded and infinitely more competitive, jeopardizing the quality of the work. You know, there's a pressure to make more of it and make it faster. And, you know, in order to compete, the content of the work has changed in order to appeal to wider audiences. And I actually noticed this in my research on Slenderman for that bonus episode. I found posts in the Creepypasta subreddit where people were complaining about the prominence of AI written and narrated stories on YouTube and how that these were getting a lot of views and like the pressure they were creating for smaller creators to keep up, to be able to churn stuff out as frequently. People who had been, like, before this, like, spending so much of their time, like, writing, recording, putting out stuff for people are now being completely pushed aside or, like, made redundant by AI or by people who wouldn't have the time or patience or creativity to do these things on their own but know how to work a generative AI software and therefore now can compete with people who've taken the time and patience to do it themselves.
It's like monotonizing the skill set, like, or like monotonizing, like, I don't know, like, I feel like these are like such funny, interesting hobbies that people are just doing for free. And like, you know, people developing Slenderman, for example, like we talk about on Something Awful and like their Photoshop skills, it's like that's a specific skill out there, and instead like we're all just gonna have one skill, which is to operate AI, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I've said this on the show before, but like I took a long time to like teach myself how to use Adobe. I'm nowhere near like a master of it, but I'm pretty proud of the progress that I've made over the years. It's something that I should be able to use to my advantage, you know, monetarily if I wanted to. But now it kind of feels like a lot of that time was wasted in a sense, because it's not really something that matters if you can utilize generative AI to create better products than the type of stuff that like I still would have felt really proud to make. And then also thinking about, you know, by Thilo's metric, what you do on YouTube and what we do on this show is kind of a form of folk art. We do everything ourselves. We rely on the engagement of a niche audience to support our work, and we rely on their feedback. It fuels what we do. We're performing to people. And I don't know, like, I feel like I know the answer to this, but like, have you felt the pressure of this kind of overcrowded market that's now being made at the hands of people being able to do things more easily with AI tools? Like, do you feel this is going to change your content, or it already has?
Not as of yet, because I feel like it's not intelligent enough yet.
Ha ha ha. Yes, mama. Except when we go on JSTOR to research shit, like, I take the time to read articles, but JSTOR is offering me a research AI tool to do that for me. Yeah. It's like stuff that I want to do, but like the internet is assuming I don't want to.
Listen, girl, ChatGPT is wanting me to cut you and Sarah right out of the video making process and just fucking use it. I don't want to, though, because it's not fucking fun and I don't get to key with my genius friends. I'll be lonely.
And also, I'd like to say that even if ChatGPT can maybe summarize information faster than I can, it's not necessarily going to have the same insights that we can make. It's not going to necessarily have a fresh insight, because it's basing what it's doing, whatever, off of like what people have already said. Already it's made. Not like,
yeah, yeah.
I guess it's just like, I think like, I mean, people are trying to make AI podcasts. People, if they wanted to make a podcast similar to our show, but spend less time doing it, they could use AI. Like, I do think that these are things that like will threaten what we do over time more and more. I also just think that like now there's so much content being made, and Thilo brings this up, like also so much slop that people are choosing to entertain themselves with instead of like thoughtfully made work, that it is going to like make it harder out there, because people's attention is expensive and precious and it's hard to capture it. If they're basically going on these like high sugar diets, metaphorically speaking, of AI slop, and then we're like, hey, I made like a nice home cooked meal for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, like, you would hope that people are kind of like yearning for that home cooked meal. Such as us sending those Cocktober texts.
Well, yes. And Thilo actually made a good point. He kind of talked about how in the wake of the Industrial Revolution, what happened was like artisan-made goods became more expensive. And there was still a market for them. It was just a smaller market that obviously like upped the prices. But that like there are people who do kind of crave those experiences, and like we're seeing people who crave things that are like more thoughtfully made now, almost as like a conscious alternative to all the slop that's being served up.
Totally.
And with all of this in mind, there's this 2009 article by Trevor J. Blank, who's a digital folklorist who I read a lot in my research process. And he argued the validity of digital folklore on the basis that, quote, there is a human behind everything that takes place online. And this really struck me working on the episode, because like you were saying, this is becoming increasingly less true. Like, there was a time where we could talk about what we put online as like being an extension of human life, because it literally was. Obviously now we're losing sight of that. And so with this in mind, I want to return to the chain email one more time. The chain email differs from a lot of the other examples of digital folk culture that we were just discussing, in the sense that everyone hates them, as we've established. But it would go against the very thesis of this show if we didn't try and provide an alternative and nuanced perspective. So I want to do that to close off the episode. So we talked earlier about some of the reasons people might forward chain emails, and I wanted to provide one more. When I got my first email address, I was living abroad for the year in Silver Spring. I was 10, and before this, I had basically had the same friend group and community in Toronto for my entire childhood. During this time, I was exchanging emails with my friends back home on a daily basis. It was a lifeline to keep in touch with the people I missed. But simultaneously, being able to email and GChat, do you remember that? Like the instant messaging on Gmail?
I didn't have Gmail till so late, baby. I had Hotmail because I was a dinosaur.
I was on Gmail and I was instant messaging with my friends, and being able to do all of that with my new friends in Maryland really helped me ingratiate myself with them socially. And then when I moved back to Toronto the next year, it allowed us to keep in touch in a way we probably wouldn't have been able to for as long. And so when I would receive chain emails from either of these groups, my Toronto friends or my Maryland friends, it helped me feel like I still belonged to either social circle despite our geographic distance. And when I would forward a chain from, you know, a Toronto friend to a Maryland friend, you know, like, oh, all my Toronto friends are sending these chain emails around, well, now I'm going to pass it over to the Maryland group. It also, like, let me bridge this gap between my two lives by having us all participate in something together. And I just think that beyond all the other tactics of persuasion that are incited by chain emails that we discussed above, the strongest force working for them is that desire to participate. And there is something really human about them in that sense. And I guess when we're thinking about, like, the increasingly less human internet and how that's going to look in the future, I don't know, it makes me now have a much fonder reading of something as annoying as a chain email.
Yeah, I think there's a sense of community there that feels exciting. You know, you can meet someone who you did not grow up with and probably reference like Mickey Mouse or like one of the Michael Jackson emails, and they'd be like, oh yeah, I got those too, you know, like it is it does bridge people across distances. And yeah, I don't know, I find folklore so fascinating. I mean, it's just so exciting to start reciting like whatever Stella Elola or something to someone, and then they pick up on it, and then you both sing it, and you sing it the whole time, and you're like, where did this start? How did this begin? Like, who originated this? And there's no idea there, and you won't know, and it's like this beautiful mystery of like human tradition and human torch passing, I guess.
Yeah.
And chainmail feels like a funny extension of that, regardless of how like whatever trashy it might be. I miss chainmail. I mean, part of it probably might be coming out of just this empty nostalgia era for like old technology where we're like fetishizing these like old objects, which has its own flaws, obviously. But like, I don't know. I'm nostalgic about it. I miss it. Send me your stupid fucking Mickey Mouse emails again.
So to close off this episode, I guess it won't be Cocktober by the time this is released. I would like to wish you guys a belated Cocktober. Boo, sorry, did I scare you? What's up, girl? It's Cocktober. And if you are getting this, it means you're a Halloween ho. Every year in Cocktober, the Jacko slut comes to life, coming to harvest his hoes for Thought-O-Ween. Send this to 10 other Halloween hoes, or else you a trick. If you get 4 back, you're a Thought-O-Ween treat. If you get 6 back, you're a slutty witch, bitch. But if you get 10 back, you're the spookiest slut on the block. If you don't send this to 10 other thoughts, you will get no dick this Cocktober.